Welcome to the Press On podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from James Andrews on the emergence of Christadelphians.
Like a young sapling, he grew up straight and comely, not warped or twisted by any influence whatever, free from theological priggishness or prejudice, though not free from a then unconfessed dislike of miserable sectarianism. This early 20th century description of Christadelphian founder John Thomas, 1805 to 1871, conveys the impression that he emerged in a vacuum, completely uninfluenced by wider Christian thought or history. This perception also tends to be reflected in our identity and self-understanding as Christadelphians. We view our community as being founded on the Bible and modelled directly on the beliefs and practices of the first century church, rather than being connected to any wider historical traditions. Yet as we saw in the previous article, which considered the background to Christadelphian beliefs, there are actually many themes from the history of Christian thought which have fed into the formation and identity of our community. In fact, the very ideas of seeing the Bible as our sole authority, or of returning to the apostolic ideal of the early church, are ideas which flow from broader currents of Christian history. In this article, we'll be exploring the immediate background to John Thomas and the early Christadelphian community. In doing so, we'll see that far from being free of any influence whatever, John Thomas was a man of his time, as we all are. I hope that this historical perspective will help us to think about how we fit into the broader history of Christianity, leading us both to consider what is valuable in the historical influences that have shaped us, and to reflect on how we see ourselves in relation to other Christians today. One of the earliest influences on John Thomas was that of his father, the Reverend John Thomas, 1782 to 1864, who was a minister to a number of nonconformist congregations in Britain and later in the United States. Some of his writings survive and reflect a Calvinist or Reformed understanding of Christian theology, emphasizing human sinfulness and the doctrine of predestination. The Reverend John Thomas's ministry reflects a number of aspects of nonconformist religion in Britain at the time, including a combative approach to religious life and debate. The Reverend John Thomas seems to have fallen out with at least two of the congregations he ministered to, describing the deacons of one church as cold as cucumbers and difficult to work with. This approach was particularly manifested in a strong anti-Catholicism. For example, in 1821, he refused to participate in a procession to mark the coronation of King George IV because it also included local Catholics. Later, in 1853, he wrote a denunciation of popery in the Middle Ages and in his own time. Belief in the Bible as the sole source of religious truth, and a refusal to compromise with anyone who disagreed with his understanding of what it taught. In an early sermon, he spoke of the unavoidably controversial nature of his arguments, but maintained that it was folly to be determined in our opinions by mere human authority. A keen interest in Bible prophecy, which he believed was being fulfilled in his own lifetime. He was a post-millennialist, meaning he believed Christ would return after a millennial golden age, which would see the world fully Christianized through the preaching of the gospel. In particular, he believed the widespread distribution of new Bible translations by the Baptist Missionary Society would help to spread the empire of Jesus Christ over the whole earth. An emphasis on a reasoned approach to the scriptures. The age of the Enlightenment posed a challenge to traditional Christianity, emphasizing reason over revelation. However, it also led many Christians, including the Reverend John Thomas, to develop a defense of the Bible which was itself based on rational inquiry. In 1831, the Reverend John Thomas published The Challenge of a Deist Accepted, in which he emphasized the authority of the Bible, but also argued that this was compatible with reason and the scientific discoveries of the age. Some of his conclusions, like the acceptance of geological evidence for the age of the earth, were shared by his son. By 1829, the younger John Thomas had completed his medical studies, and in 1832 he set sail for America, intending to pursue his medical career. Although religious inquiry was not the main purpose of his emigration to the United States, he was far from being uninfluenced by his upbringing in nonconformist religious circles. He travelled as ship's chaplain, as well as its doctor. His early medical writings reveal belief in traditional religious doctrines, such as the immortality of the soul. And he wrote of his time in England before the voyage that, "I had examined the evidences of Christianity, had devoted much time to the study of prophecy, and had watched the progress of events in the history of human affairs as corroborative of the Book of God." Nevertheless, a significant experience on board the ship during his passage prompted the young Dr. Thomas to turn his full attention to examining his Christian faith. During the passage, his ship encountered a long period of severe weather, which led to serious fears for the lives of the passengers. Although the ship eventually reached New York after a voyage of 8 weeks, the storm prompted Thomas to determine not to rest until we found the true way to immortality. It is worth noting that Thomas's storm experience fits into a pattern of maritime conversion accounts by Christians in the 18th and early 19th centuries, notably including those of Methodist founder John Wesley in 1736, and of one-time trader of enslaved people, and later abolitionist, John Newton in 1748. These conversions were not to Christianity from atheism, but rather a deeper commitment to an already existing Christian faith. Thomas's nonconformist background had given him not only a point of departure from which to explore wider Christian ideas, it had also given him certain convictions that pure Christian truth could be discovered and defined, that it could be found through searching the scriptures and rational inquiry, and that the sphere of such inquiry and debate would not be within established Christian institutions, but within congregations of believers committed to similar ideas. His storm experience provided the catalyst for the next stage in his journey of Christian exploration. The religious landscape of North America at that time was highly diverse and complex, with a wide variety of churches and denominations, and an enthusiasm for religious debate encouraged by a movement of evangelical revival known as the Second Great Awakening. Within this context, the Restoration Movement was born, aiming to restore primitive Christianity by stripping away all creeds and church traditions, and so to bring about unity between all Christians around simple biblical ideals. The movement's high ambitions stemmed from both an optimism about the possibilities of the new American Republic and a frustration about the sheer number of competing Christian denominations. It comprised a number of like-minded groups, principally the Christians, led by Barton W. Stone, 1772 to 1844, and the Disciples of Christ, led by Thomas Campbell, 1763 to 1854, and his son Alexander Campbell, 1788 to 1866. The two groups united in 1832. The majority of churches in the combined movement later formed what would become known as the Churches of Christ. Alexander Campbell was an Ulster Scot and originally a member of the Cedar Presbyterian Church, a breakaway branch of the Church of Scotland. He had migrated to Pennsylvania in 1809, and together with his father soon joined a Baptist church. He became known as a prominent debater, and in 1823 established a monthly magazine known as the Christian Baptist. In his preaching and writing, he gradually moved away from Baptist positions, developing key ideas which became the hallmarks of the Restoration Movement, including a rejection of all forms of clerical authority or church hierarchy, including interchurch organisations such as missionary societies, and an emphasis on the equal responsibility of all believers to read and interpret the scriptures for themselves. An emphasis on the Bible alone as the single rule of faith, albeit with an emphasis on the priority of the New Testament, and a rejection of anything not found in the Bible, including instrumental music. This also led to the avoidance of the non-biblical word Trinity and associated terminology, although the doctrine was not explicitly rejected. A rational approach to Christian faith and biblical interpretation, Campbell and others in the Restoration movement rejected revival-style meetings popular among some branches of Christianity at this time. A post-millennialist expectation that the re-establishment of true Christianity and the unity of all Christians would lead to the millennial era described in Revelation 20 to be followed by the return of Christ. Soon after John Thomas's arrival in the United States, he travelled to Cincinnati, where he was introduced to a local congregation of Disciples of Christ, or Campbellites. Within a week, he was baptised by full immersion in the Miami Canal. This rather swift response reflects Thomas's pre-existing Christian faith, but also the fact that he saw within the Restoration movement the opportunity to further develop and debate religious ideas with like-minded believers. Over the following years, Thomas gained a reputation among Disciples of Christ congregations as a powerful preacher in his own right. In May 1834, he began his own periodical. Its name, the Apostolic Advocate, reflected the aim of the Restoration movement to return to the apostolic ideals of the early church. However, Thomas soon developed a stricter approach to baptism than Campbell, insisting on the rebaptism of those who had previously been baptized at Baptist churches, since they were immersed ignorantly the first time, not knowing the gospel. This position represents a key tension within the Restoration movement as a whole. On the one hand, it aimed to unify all Christians by returning to the simple tenets of early Christianity. On the other hand, divisions could easily appear when disagreements arose over what those tenets actually were. Alexander Campbell, particularly in his later life, took a more moderate approach, seeking to hold his principles in balance with an ecumenical program around which Christians could, at least theoretically, unite. John Thomas was more uncompromising in his pursuit of what he believed to be biblical truth. In some ways, he was simply pursuing Campbell's ideas to their logical conclusion. As he wrote in 1838, "I only applied what he had previously taught." However, the consequence was, eventually, a group which required new believers to accept a defined set of beliefs and receive baptism again. Ironically, the opposite of Campbell's vision of a non-denominational and universal true church. During the 1830s and 40s, as his disagreements with Campbell deepened, Thomas began to engage with a wider range of ideas, including in his periodicals The Apostolic Advocate until 1839 and The Investigator, which ran for just a few months in 1842. It was in The Apostolic Advocate that he first began to challenge the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, posing a series of open but arguably leading questions in the edition of the 1st of December 1835. He also had many direct encounters with other Christian groups. The Schwarzenau Brethren, also known as the Dunkers or Dunkards, were German Anabaptists descended from the communities of the Radical Reformation, discussed in the previous article. In October 1835, Thomas recalled his visit to the Honest Dunkards of Magotty, Virginia, and particularly records a discussion about their refusal to take up arms or hold enslaved people. Thomas was to adopt the former principle, but sadly not the latter. Thomas encountered the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormons, in the period 1839 to 1843, which he spent in Illinois, where a large number of Mormons were based prior to their migration west to the Salt Lake Valley. Mormons were also born out of the Restoration movement and shared its fundamental aims. In 1842, Thomas held a debate with a Mormon elder, vehemently disagreeing with him about the authority of the Book of Mormon. Also considered part of the Restoration movement, William Miller, 1782 to 1849, was originally a Baptist, later a deist, who in 1816 reconverted to Christianity and attempted to apply the rationalist approach to religion he had found in deism to the details of Bible prophecy. His detailed calculations led him to conclude that Christ would return sometime between the 21st of March 1843 and the 21st of March 1844. From 1831, he began to disseminate his calculations, helping to popularize premillennialism, the belief that the second advent of Christ would take place before the millennium. The failure of Miller's predictions led to the so-called Great Disappointment, but his followers were later reorganized and his teachings became the basis of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. John Thomas was directly influenced by Miller's premillennialist theology. Writing to the Millerite publication, The Western Midnight Cry, "The great truth to the propagation of which your paper is devoted is the grandest, most comforting, animating, and soul-stirring in the whole scriptures." It was Miller's writings which prompted Thomas to change his understanding from a postmillennial to a premillennial view of Christ's return, as reflected in the title of the new periodical Thomas began in 1845, The Herald of the Future Age. In the very first issue of the Herald, following the failure of Miller's own predictions, Thomas outlined his own recalculations and predicted that Christ would return in 1866. His premillennial theology was developed further in Elpis Israel, 1850, and later in Eureka, an Exposition of the Apocalypse, published between 1861 and 1868. Interestingly, Eureka also owes a large debt to a similar work by Edward Bishop Elliot, entitled Horae Apocalypticae, first published in 1844. Though an evangelical and a premillennialist, Elliot was not part of the Restoration movement, but a Church of England clergyman, reflecting the fact that the lines of religious influence are not always clear-cut. In 1847, Thomas made his final break with the Disciples of Christ, Campbellite Church, being rebaptized and publishing his Confession and Abjuration and a declaration of his new understanding. However, he continued to preach to Millerite and Campbellite congregations in the United States and Britain, and some of these became the first Christadelphian churches. The name Christadelphian was only coined in 1864 during the American Civil War, when followers of John Thomas needed a name under which to register their objection to conscription. In 1862, Thomas's close admirer in Britain, Robert Roberts, published his 12 Lectures, later renamed Christendom Astray in 1884, setting out the true nature of the ancient apostolic faith in a more systematic way, and helping to define Christadelphian doctrine and teaching. Later, in 1869, Roberts would write, "I got the truth from reading Dr. Thomas's works 15 years ago. I discovered nothing for myself. There was nothing to discover." Considering the various influences upon John Thomas and the first Christadelphian communities, one historian of American religion has concluded that Christadelphians are a fascinating hybrid combining Restorationist, Adventist, and Anabaptist doctrines. Having reached a more settled understanding of Bible truth, Thomas was often uncompromising in his criticism of those who had not come to share his views, although he did admit, somewhat ruefully, a taste for theological gladiatorship. But as we have seen, although Thomas was undoubtedly a bold and sometimes original thinker, the debt of these wider influences on his Christian faith and understanding is undeniable. In this article, I've tried to be as fair and objective as possible in my account both of John Thomas and of the wider nonconformist and restoration influences on his thinking. However, I'll conclude with some personal reflections on the Christadelphian legacy and on what this might mean for our relationship with other Christians today. It seems to me that there were two key impulses at work in the early Christadelphian movement. The first was the promotion of free thought, inquiry, debate, and an emphasis on the equal duty of every Christian to search the scriptures for themselves, wherever such a search might lead, and without deference to any church authority. Sometimes we might regret the language in which debate and disagreement was expressed, although it's worth noting that theological debates on social media today are often no more civil. However, as examples from the wider nonconformist churches and restoration movement show, this was part of the theological discourse of the day. The polemical debates of early Christadelphians actually locate our movement within this world of passionate debate about faith and the scriptures, although it should be acknowledged that some churches have moved on from using adversarial language about those they disagree with to a greater extent than we have. The second impulse at work in the Christadelphia movement has been the impulse to preserve and defend our understanding of Bible truth once arrived at. However, this impulse has unfortunately often led to the closing down or stifling of debate, or to the insistence on agreement on all aspects of Bible truth, even at the cost of acrimony and division over relatively minor matters. My own view is that the legacy we have, the framework which the early Christadelphian writers left us for understanding the full message of the Bible, is a valuable basis on which to build our Christian faith and understanding. However, I do feel that this aspect of our legacy has been preserved at the expense of the impulse to allow and promote free inquiry into the scriptures, even if this may sometimes lead us in new and challenging directions. I would personally like to see a rebalancing towards a freer and more genuinely open spirit of exploration and debate, without losing the aim of a shared pursuit of a biblically informed faith. In the previous article, we discussed the difference between the church as a state institution and the ideal of the church as a voluntary association of believers. Yet throughout most historically Christian countries, this distinction has arguably now broken down. Even the Catholic Church formally recognized the individual's right to religious freedom in a declaration of the Second Vatican Council. Today, most people who attend church do so voluntarily, as a result of a personal faith commitment rather than social expectation or compulsion. In this respect, as Christadelphians, we already have a common starting point for discussion with other Christian friends and neighbours. What's more, while no other church may fully share all aspects of our understanding of Bible teaching, there are Christians who do share aspects of our beliefs, such as believers' baptism, hope in the second coming of Christ and the resurrection of the dead, and even in the biblical Unitarian movement, our non-Trinitarian theology. These shared beliefs are a basis too for further dialogue, discussion, and understanding. More broadly, I hope these articles have shown that, at least on some level, there are many churches with which we share aspects of our historical lineage. We are part of the rich tapestry of Christian thought and discussion, inheriting ideas, practices, and debates that have come down to us through the centuries. Fellow Christadelphians will have different views and feelings about the extent to which we should engage with or see ourselves as part of wider Christian history. But for my part, I do find myself moved by examples of reconciliation between Christians from different traditions. One such moment of reconciliation took place in Zurich in 2004, when members of the Evangelical Reformed Church and the Anabaptist Swiss Mennonite Conference gathered on the banks of the river Limmat. This was the location where, almost 500 years earlier, the city's Protestant authorities had put Anabaptist believers to death by drowning. At the reconciliation event in 2004, representatives of the Evangelical Reformed Church shared a statement of regret, followed by an acknowledgement by the president of the Mennonite Conference, who concluded his statement as follows. Today, Zurich has become a prosperous and flourishing city where rebaptisms should no longer disturb the public order. However, what would this city be without divine grace and generations of men and women filled with the Word of God and with Judeo-Christian values? At one time divided, we want today, in the midst of our society, to join our voices to yours, dear Reformed friends, in order to repeat together the message of him who touches and transforms hearts, who is none other than Jesus Christ, our Lord.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to James Andrews. For more, you can visit pressonjournal.org.